In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Since you're listening to this podcast, we have a very special offer for you. You can try 6 issues of BBC History Revealed magazine for just £9.99. That's a saving of 70% on the shop price. BBC History Revealed is the all-action history magazine suitable for the whole family. To find out more and take advantage of this offer, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast. And if you're based in the US, you won't miss out. You can try 3 issues for just £9.95, saving a huge 70%. For more details, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast. Both these offers end on the 15th of May, 2021. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. What was the daily routine in a British workhouse? Who would end up there? How accurate is Dickens' depiction of workhouse life? And did the inmates really eat gruel? Well, in today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, we're exploring life in the workhouse. I put your questions to Peter Higginbotham, a historian and writer who's shared his expertise on the workhouse on shows such as Who Do You Think You Are and Radio 4's Making History, and also runs the website workhouses.org.uk. Thanks very much for joining me, Peter, to talk all about the workhouse. We've had loads of questions in from social media. So let's start with one that's actually not from social media. It's basically the most searched for internet term about the workhouse, which is, what was the workhouse? Where do we start with that?
Well, the workhouse was always part of what we'd call the welfare system, or in those days, the poor relief system. And that really goes back to the Elizabethan days. Parishes started collecting money from all their householders. And most of that money was actually used as handouts. Pensions even actually even date back to that kind of that period. And the workhouse kind of grew up within that welfare system. And it really had two main functions. One, it was a place where people who couldn't even get by with a handout, the elderly, the chronically sick, the mentally ill, orphan children, those sort of people needed a refuge, somewhere that would look after them. And later on, it also took on another function, which was for dealing with what were called the able-bodied poor. People, you know, who were quite capable of working, but for some reason weren't earning any money. And if those people wanted help from the parish, then instead of a handout, they could be offered a place in this institution called the workhouse, where they would really have to work in return for their board and lodging. And in fact, the workhouse became what's called a test of someone's destitution or need. If they were prepared to go to this place, then that was fine. They were clearly deserving. If it worked, as far as the parish was concerned, it would bring down the cost of looking after the poor. You'd get rid of lots of people who were really deserving of help by only offering them the workhouse. Probably about 1 in 5, 1 in 6 parishes over the years decided to run a workhouse. But handouts were always the main way of helping the poor. The workhouse, although it's the most kind of visible part of this whole welfare system, was actually in financial terms and in numbers of people who were being helped was a bit of a minor player. But anyway, we will focus on the workhouse and see where that takes us. One thing I should also say is that there was a big change in this whole system in 1834. If ever you read about the workhouse, that's a year that always crops up. In the years running up to 1834, the national cost of all these handouts was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, particularly after the Napoleonic Wars ended and then lots of people started claiming poor relief. And the whole system was reorganized, and the new system that came in 1834 was a standard national system. There were workhouses everywhere. The country was divided up into new, bigger areas, not the little parish anymore, but a bigger unit called the Poor Law Union. And that was run by a local committee of elected guardians, they were known, who administered the system. And the new system was aimed really to bring down the cost of these the handouts looking after the poor. And in the new system, the workhouse was a more prominent part. And it was really aim was if you were able-bodied, then wherever you were, the only option on offer if you wanted help would be the workhouse.
So as you mentioned, there was big transformations and changes in the way that workhouses operated. But Megan Maguire-Abeed asks, when did they start? So would you say it is that Elizabethan period?
Well, there were things that we would probably describe as workhouses starting to appear in the 1620s, 1630s. But it really kicked off in the 1720s. Parliament passed an act called the Workhouse Test Act, which for the first time crystallised a kind of a legal framework for running a workhouse. And then there was a whole boom of workhouses, parish workhouses, set up in the following decades.
And AGM Calise asks, how many were in operation? Obviously, that number's going to be different at the different time periods you're looking at.
Yeah. In the parish era, the pre-1834 era, I think it's been estimated in the 1810s, 1820s, there were probably as many as 3,000 workhouses, which sounds a lot, but again, there are 15,000 parishes.
And was that across the whole of Britain?
That was England and Wales. After 1834, we had bigger workhouses serving larger areas, so rather fewer of them, but they were bigger. And there were somewhere between 600 and 650 of these kind of what we think of as Victorian big workhouses.
So now we've covered off the basics of how these operated. I've got a question from Daniel O'Donnell, actually, which is how accurate was Oliver Twist and Dickens' wider writings about the workhouse? And you would not believe how many questions that we had in were about Charles Dickens.
Well, so certainly Oliver Twist has created the picture that most people have in their minds about workhouses. Interestingly, Oliver Twist was began publication in 1837, which is when the new system had started. But it actually, the workhouse it talks about is a pre-1834 parish workhouse. And it's got elements of truth in it. You know, it was a large building full of poor people, you could say. But it was really a caricature as much as anything. So, for example, the committee that ran the workhouse in the Dickens' book were described as being in solemn enclave when the beadle burst in saying, "Oliver's asked for war." Whereas if you think of the film, say the musical of Oliver, they're all stuffing their faces and looking like fat, you know, evil beasts. So certainly Oliver Twist and lots of the versions of it that appeared over the years have created this picture that's far from the truth. In Oliver Twist, the boys in the workhouse, if I remember rightly, exist on a diet of gruel and an onion on Sundays. And there was never a workhouse where that was the diet. You know, there was never a workhouse where the inmates existed solely on gruel. And in fact, in some workhouses, the food was very good. You know, you've got three very square meals a day. It varied enormously, though, because each parish could do its own thing, and some parishes were obviously sort of more generous than others in what they provided. But interestingly, the sort of the negative parts of Oliver Twist were used to sort of run down the new system. If you remember the musical Oliver, there's a song called Boy for Sale.
Yes.
Now, workhouses never sold boys. They were offered for apprenticeships, but they came with money. Not, you didn't get money from their future employer. You gave some money for him to take them off their hands. So there's lots of sort of distortions, you know, that have in Oliver Twist, and have been bolted on to Oliver Twist over the years. On the other hand, if you look at Dickens's more journalistic writings in the various magazines that he was involved in, he visited a few workhouses and related establishments and was actually sometimes quite either complimentary or sympathetic towards them. So I think, you know, viewing Dickens as a stern, you know, critic of the workhouse is probably, you know, not a fair picture.
Next, I'm going to ask you a question that we've had in from Dee Weaver on Facebook, which is an interesting one, who says, many of the workhouse buildings are incredibly beautiful. And she says, like the Thackeray Medical Museum in Leeds, if people know that one. So why was so much cost put into building them to then be so miserly with the inmates?
Well, that's an interesting question. Some of the early post-1834 workhouses, like Leeds, were actually quite sort of stern-looking buildings, almost kind of prison-like in their appearance. And that gradually changed over the next few decades. And it is kind of in line with the increasing prosperity of Britain. Some of the more, what you'd call elegant ones from the 1850s, 1860s, really reflected the growing richness of Britain. And a lot of big towns like Leeds decided that they wanted to show kind of how much they cared for the poor, if you like, reflected in the appearance of the building. However, it was very much the front of the building that was the elegant-looking bit. You know, if you look behind the frontage, it often became, you know, much plainer and simply constructed. It was interesting, though, some of the most eminent architects of the Victorian period began their careers designing workhouses. Sir George Gilbert Scott, one of the most well-known Victorian architects, you know, who designed the St. Pancras Station and I think the Albert Memorial and so on. He began his career designing workhouses because it was a very lucrative business to be in. You got paid a percentage of the cost price of the building. And if you designed a very big building, your 3% or whatever it was actually quite a decent cut. So it's kind of an interesting story that goes with that.
So let's talk a bit about the experience of being in a workhouse. Laurelise XO asks, who qualified to live in the workhouses? And actually, I might add on another question to that from Lydia the Klein, who asks, what was the process of admitting inmates like?
Right. To gain entry into a workhouse, you had to live in its catchment area, is kind of the term we would probably use, either in the parish or in one of the parishes that made up one of these poor law unions. As far as the admission process goes, you generally didn't just turn up at the workhouse and knock on the door. There was an official called the relieving officer, who was the frontline official of the system. And generally, they visited each bit of the union two or three times a week. So you knew if you lived in sort of Stoke Poges, you know, he'd be at the Dog and Duck at 2 o'clock on Thursdays. And if you felt like, you know, you wanted to ask for help, you would go and queue up and tell him your sob story. You'd probably be hoping for a handout, because actually handouts never quite went away. But certainly if you were able-bodied, he'd say, sorry, all I can offer you is the workhouse. And it was always an offer. You never put in the workhouse, sent to the workhouse, sentenced to the workhouse. It was always an offer. And it's a bit like today, if you're unemployed, there's unemployment assistance, but you're not forced to claim it. You know, it's there to be asked for. So if you decided to take up that very kind offer, you would make your way to the workhouse, and there'll be quite a long admission process. You'd have your details taken, you'd have a bath and a medical. You weren't wanting to take any horrible infectious disease into the workhouse, and smallpox was a very big concern in Victorian times. So there was like a quarantine period kept in on the edge of the main workhouse. And you were also given workhouse clothing, or uniform, as it's sometimes referred. It was never called uniform officially, but clothing. Some people have a bit of a thing about the workhouse clothing. They see it as kind of this dehumanizing kind of process. You're forced into this straitjacket of a uniform. But clearly, if you turn up at a workhouse wearing one set of rags, then you really want something a bit better than that for your time in the workhouse, particularly if you're going to be working. And if you turn up in your one set of rags, what happens when those rags want washing? You're going to wander around, in your undies. So it was a very practical thing. Your own clothes were put into storage, possibly having been fumigated first. In the workhouse, the clothing got washed, and it wasn't actually always identical. It tended to be bought in bulk, or the inmates made it themselves. It wasn't completely random, but it was of a similar type.
So it's not like everybody was wearing striped jumpsuits with an inmate number on it, or
exactly,
anything like that.
Exactly, yeah. As regards leaving the workhouse, it wasn't a prison. You could leave any time you wanted, in principle. However, you couldn't just waltz out the door whenever you felt like it. If you were wearing workhouse uniform and you left the premises without permission wearing your workhouse uniform, you could be charged with stealing workhouse property. And that was one kind of control that the staff had over people just coming and going as they wished. If you wanted to leave the building before you were formally discharged, you would need to get permission. When you did want to leave permanently, then you gave a few hours' notice of your intent to discharge yourself. Your own clothes were fetched out of storage, a bit more paperwork, and you went on your way. So that was really how it worked.
I think that leads us on nicely to a couple of questions, actually, that I've had from Rosie Barr and Teresa 88. So Rosie Barr asks, to what extent did people move in and out again of the workhouse? And Teresa 88 asks, and what was the average amount of time that people spent in the workhouse? So was it something that you just go to once and then leave and you'd never go back? Or would you be back and forth between the outside world and the workhouse?
They were all points in between. For some people, particularly the elderly or the chronic sick, if you went into a workhouse, there was a fair chance you might stay there for the rest of your life. Because workhouses and workhouse infirmaries were the only form of very long-term geriatric care, we'd probably say, that there was. So once you were in, that was pretty much it. You could leave if you felt capable, but that was the situation. So you could spend the rest of your life there if you happened to be in that situation. At the other end of the scale, there are people who are usually referred to as the ins and outs. They use the workhouse just like a free lodging house. And they turn up on a Monday, get checked in, stay there a couple of days, and then decide they'd had enough. And they discharge themselves, go and visit Auntie Flo, in the next village, and then she'd throw you out and you'd be back on the workhouse doorstep a couple of days later. There were people who literally checked themselves in and out of the workhouse dozens and dozens of times a year for different amounts of time. Anything between, even just down as little as one day. They'd go in and said, stuff this for a laugh. In the 1870s, the rules were changed slightly so that if you had been in the last month, then you couldn't leave within so many days. And the more times you'd just been in and out, the longer you had to stay until you could discharge yourself again. So it was, but up till that point, these people were the bane of the workhouse staff life because there was this long admission discharge procedure, even if you left the next day and you had to go round and round every time they came and went.
That's really interesting. So next up, I've got a question from Michelle Ruse, and Dickens is making a reappearance here, who says, there's a quote from Dickens' A Christmas Carol, where one of the characters tells Scrooge that some people would rather die than enter a workhouse. But to what extent were workhouses actually a saving grace for many people?
That's a very good question. You always have to view the workhouse in terms of life outside the workhouse for poor people at the time. For a lot of poor people, life was pretty tough. They might be scraping along, really on the verge of needing, the help of the workhouse, but pride prevented them. So they, you know, they were living, you know, maybe on sort of literally bread and water in, you know, 12 to a room, you know, in some very down and out, dirty hovel. And for those kind of people, there was often a choice between sticking that out, hoping things might improve, you know, a job might turn up, or surrendering themselves to the workhouse, where, you know, you've got 3 square meals a day. You had to put up with sleeping in a dormitory with other people, having to do work if you're able-bodied, and being separated, you know, from other people. But, you know, it possibly had some attractions. It was a kind of, you know, a difficult choice to make, possibly.
And there would be stigma attached, would there, too?
Yeah, there was. There became, well, again, for some people, certainly, what you might call decent people, the workhouse represented, I mean, you could say it's a failure. You couldn't pay your rent. You couldn't put bread on the table, you know, and you were in a sinking sort of ship, as it were. And, you know, life was tough, but, you know, people had their pride. And the workhouse was a bit of a poverty trap in a way. When you left the workhouse, if you decided to leave the workhouse, you weren't given a handout to get you going again. You know, you somehow had to find somewhere to live. Maybe, you know, say, I'll pay you the rent in a few weeks' time. You had to get a job, you know, and hopefully persuade someone to give you a bit of an advance, you know, on your wages. But it was really difficult, you know, to get going again once you're in the workhouse, because you left all the things, you know, that you associate with a stable life. And it was a pretty tough thing. It was difficult for people. And there was an attraction in trying to avoid going in the workhouse. But it certainly was a stigma. And in fact, this was recognised by the authorities at one point in 1904. The Registrar General, as the office that issues birth, marriage and death certificates, decided that from that date onwards, if you were born in a workhouse, then that word needn't appear on your birth certificate. You could have some kind of anonymous street address instead. So no one would ever know that you'd been born in the workhouse, and that kind of stigma wouldn't follow you around for the rest of your life. But there certainly was a stigma. It's sometimes said that that was, to a degree, encouraged by the authorities in order to dissuade people from seeking help. I've never seen any evidence for that, but it's one of those things that's, you know, you hear said about the workhouse.
So you mentioned there the possibility of being separated from people, and Lindsay Jones Murray asked on Facebook, I've heard that families were separated upon entering. Did they ever get reunited? And if someone was sick or dying, would they bring their family in to be with them?
That's certainly true that families were separated. When you went into the workhouse, you were put into a category or a class as soon as you entered the door. So male and female inmates were always separated. And within those, there was a separation of the elderly and infirm, the able-bodied boys, girls, 7 to 15, and the under sevens was the final kind of grouping. And each of those categories had their own section of the building. And once you went in, then broadly speaking, you know, you confined to your own section of the building until you left. There were some minor exceptions to that. Parents who had children in the same workhouse could see their children. Officially, you could have a daily appointment with your children, supervised, you know, by the workhouse staff. In practice, what usually happened was that on Sunday afternoons, one or other of the parents could meet up with the children, possibly in the big dining hall, or they could swap over. But the two parents weren't allowed to meet.
That seems somehow unnecessarily cruel. What was the thinking, the ideology behind keeping everybody separated from their family members?
Well, officially, it was to maintain discipline, was how it was expressed. Certainly, adult males and females could possibly get up to all sorts of shenanigans if they weren't carefully divided. And there were lots of examples of people climbing over walls or using devious means to have assignations with the opposite sex. I think it was just convenient administratively and managerially to have people separated. in that way. It was official. There was also an element of deterrence. One of the aims of the post-1834 workhouse is that it should be an unattractive place to be. You'd rather be outside than inside. And the separation of different categories of male, female, and so on, you know, was probably part of that general attitude.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I think just approach the subject with an open mind. Don't believe these, you know, colourful, you know, caricatures that are always presented, even now, in most representations you see of the workhouse. Keep an open mind and remember that whatever you're looking at changed throughout that whole period.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Francis Bibb asks, what was a day in the life like? So can you give us a sense of the daily routine in an average workhouse?
Okay, daily life. It depends which of these categories you were in. If you were able-bodied, you'd be up at 6 in the morning. You'd have an hour where you'd be doing roll call, have some breakfast, washing, or whatever. And then from 7 till noon, you're probably doing 5 hours of work, or whatever you'd been assigned to. You get an hour for your midday dinner, another 5 hours work in the afternoon, up till 6 o'clock. You'd have your supper. There'd be an hour of unspecified time, so any kind of recreation that went on would be in that sort of early evening slot, and then you'd be in bed by 8. In the winter, I think you got up at 7 rather than 6. You had the luxury of an extra hour of bed in the morning. The elderly and the infirm, though, had a slightly more relaxed regime. On the whole, they either had a later or unspecified getting up time. The elderly and the infirm always had a slightly easier time of things. So, you know, when it came to things like food, they had a slightly better deal. But it was always quite structured. Things always happened at certain times, and there was a bell to kind of indicate that something needed to happen. Sunday was the one day of rest. No work was done on Sunday, but it was full of uplifting church services and Bible study and so on, plus the afternoon kind of get together with the children if that applied. The elderly, though, had, I think, a fairly boring time of it. They had day rooms, possibly a few worthy books to read, or if anybody had donated a few magazines. But, you know, that was it.
Mm. So for those who were working, what jobs did they do in the workhouse?
Okay. What jobs did they do? Well, the women did all the domestic work of the workhouse, so cleaning, cooking, washing, doing the laundry, sewing. In some cases, they'd be actually making workhouse clothing. And that was one of the jobs the women often took on. The men, though, if they were able-bodied, could be doing fairly demanding work. And the two favourite jobs that were used were stone breaking, as bashing up big lumps of stone into small lumps of stone, which could then be sold for road making or whatever, and oakum picking, which is picking apart old manky old ropes from ships or wherever into their raw fluffy fibres, which again could be used for, you know, then used recycled for other purposes.
Quite monotonous work then.
Yes. The one thing about the work, it wasn't allowed to compete with local industry. So even though the male inmates might be skilled carpenters, they weren't allowed to, you know, make furniture or whatever, because that would, because the labour was free, it wouldn't be a fair competition. Again, as time went on, by the early 1900s, most workhouse inmates were, you know, older people. So things like wood chopping became quite popular. Right, you know, it's still kind of manual labor, but you could quantify it very easily, and you could do it sitting down, and it was not quite so physically demanding, reflecting the change in the population.
And Lene K asks, what happened to the children? I mean, obviously, child labour was used at points in the 19th century, but was that the case in the workhouse?
Well, certainly in the post-1834 workhouse, the children were the one group that were actually what you might call well-treated. There was a lot of effort quite early on, from sort of 1840 onwards, really, to try and get children away from the adult inmates who were seen as a bad influence, and they would teach them, you know, bad ways. So there was the start of really setting up separate institutions, separate establishments for pauper children. Starting off with, you had big kind of buildings called industrial schools or separate schools, which are like literally workhouses for children, where they were educated and also taught skills to make them employable. So things like tailoring, bootmaking, carpentry, plumbing, lots of sort of basic craft skills. And the hope was that when those children left the system, you know, if they stayed long enough, that they would be employable, and they wouldn't therefore turn into workhouse inmates like their parents had. You know, workhouse children received a basic education. They got 3 hours a day of basic, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic, and religious studies, which was actually more than, you know, some of the people outside were getting. There was a debate in the early days about whether they should be taught to read and write, because that was giving them a better situation than people on the outside, which was counter to the less well-off argument. You know, again, it was decided that that would be a good thing. Again, they would become employable in the long run if they were taught to read and write.
So it wouldn't necessarily be as grim always as Oliver Twist, for example.
No, it's really strange. It's very easy when you're thinking about the workhouse to be so influenced by Oliver Twist, you know, without realizing it. And when you actually try and stand back and see, well, you know, how does that work and what's the situation, you can actually start to see it wasn't as relentlessly grim as the picture that's often painted.
Next up, we have a couple of questions about health and hygiene. So Broat Appetite, great name, asked, how was personal hygiene managed when people would have to wash, sleep and eat collectively? And Jacqueline Price has asked, what healthcare provisions existed? And to what degree was public health considered?
Right. As regards general hygiene, workhouses were generally very clean places, because keeping the place clean was one of the useful tasks you could give to the inmates. All the bedding and clothing was generally washed at least once a fortnight, and the physical premises were kept very clean. Washing was done in a large room called a lavatory. Lavatory in those days was a washroom. So if you see the word lavatory in the workhouse context, it doesn't mean what we would call a toilet. It's a washroom. So, you know, generally people, you know, wash themselves. Bathing in a bathtub was quite a rare thing to do. Most workhouses had one or two baths. But in fact, you know, in general, in Victorian times, you know, bathtubs were quite, you know, the preserve of the very, very well-to-do. So when you discover that a workhouse just had one or two bathtubs, then that's actually not such a sort of surprising thing. The facilities varied enormously, but people lived in a clean building, had clean clothes. They did have close contact. You know, they did sleep, sort of 20 or 30 to a dormitory. And occasionally you did get sort of outbreaks of things. But on the whole, it's probably surprising, actually, there wasn't more of it. When you think about it. As regards public health, well, every workhouse had its infirmary. Workhouse inmates, in the first instance, were treated in the workhouse infirmary, which was, you know, separate to any public institutions. And outside, the main medical resource at that time were voluntary hospitals, who really primarily dealt with things like surgery, accidents, so on. And, you know, there wasn't really much of a crossover between the two. The thing about the workhouse infirmary is that really up till the 1860s, workhouses were probably the worst place you'd want to get sick in to some degree, because the nursing was done by elderly female inmates on the whole. And a lot of those women couldn't read and write. They couldn't read instructions on bottles or instructions left by the doctor. And they were actually drunk most of the time. You know, they often got a ration of beer for volunteering to do the job in the first place. And a lot of the things that were dispensed to the sick poor in the workhouse infirmary, you know, were either brandy or porter or, you know, they contained alcohol in some shape or form. And a lot of that stuff didn't always quite make it to the patient. And you literally, you know, I'll be quite serious. A lot of workhouse nurses, you know, were actually the worst for wear, you know, by 9 o'clock in the morning.
Which is not really what you want from your nurse.
No, there was really a big push from the 1860s onwards, again, particularly in London, but it kind of spread out from there to improve workhouse medical care. Florence Nightingale was very involved in trying to improve workhouse nursing. And there were lots of, the medical journals published sort of hair-raising accounts of conditions that they came across. And from the 1870s onwards, there were big changes. Lots of new workhouse infirmary buildings were put up. Trained nurses were employed. And the thing that really transformed things was really from the 1870s, 1880s onwards. If you were poor outside the workhouse but couldn't afford a doctor, because you had to pay for doctors in those days, then you would increasingly be packed off to the workhouse infirmary for any treatment that you needed. And as a result of that, in many places, the workhouse infirmary became the local hospital for poor people. And again, because of that increased traffic, then the workhouse medical facilities expanded as a reaction. And in many workhouses, particularly ones in cities, the workhouse medical facilities outgrew the accommodation for the poor. They basically became large hospitals. When the National Health Service in England and Wales was formed in 1948, you know, it had this culture of free access to all, you know, actually going back 60 years or more. And it inherited a lot of workhouse sites. A big proportion of the NHS real estate in 1948 was former workhouse infirmaries. In fact, the new system was inaugurated at a workhouse infirmary up in Lancashire by Nye Bevan. So workhouse infirmaries, they made a shaky start, but once they got going, you know, they were quite a big contributor to the public health system.
So I've got a couple more questions that we'll kind of try and just race through before the end. So I know we've spoken a bit about food already, but I had such a great question in that I wanted to put it to you for a bit more detail. So Laura Fopp on Facebook said, "We've been studying Victorians for home education. So please, can you tell us about the workhouse diet?" And Laura says, "We've also been searching for an authentic recipe for gruel, watered down porridge, or is it just flour and water? You suggested maybe gruel is not quite historically accurate."
Well, it did feature in the diet, but actually what you need is my workhouse cookbook, which I produced a few years ago, kind of the history of the workhouse food, you know, going back forever, which is packed with authentic recipes. Certainly, gruel did start to feature by name as such, you know, in the 1700s, along with porridge and all sorts of stodgy things.
So, what was gruel?
Well, gruel is basically half-strength porridge. There was actually a workhouse cookery book issued in 1901, which was issued to workhouse cooks, and it contains a recipe for porridge, which is 4 ounces of oatmeal to a pint of water and a bit of salt for flavouring. Gruel is 2 ounces of oatmeal to a pint of water and a bit of treacle. So gruel is half-strength porridge. Literally, that's what it is. So it's very watery porridge. But food did change, again, like most things about the workhouse. You can't say the food was like this. All you can say is the food was like this in the 1850s or 1910s or whatever. Yeah, everything about the workhouse evolved over the years. So in the 1840s, when the workhouse was trying to be a deterrent institution, the food was very plain. For breakfast, it would probably be gruel or porridge, and possibly the same for supper in the evening, or possibly bread and cheese. Bread and cheese was a very popular staple of the workhouse diet. You might get a meat dinner two or three times a week, middle of the day, soup or broth a couple of times a week for dinner. But so that was really it. Sort of the gruel, bread and cheese, bread and cheese, gruel, bread and cheese, bread and cheese, gruel, bread and cheese. Oh, it's Tuesday. Oh, it's a meat and two veg for dinner. Oh, bread and cheese, gruel, bread and cheese, and so on. But in the early 1900s, I'd say 1901 really was the turning point. It was recognised that a lot of workhouse food was being thrown away. Because if you didn't eat your dinner, you know, you didn't come back the next time, it got put in the bin. And by 1901, a lot of workhouse inmates, you know, were the elderly and the sick and the mentally ill and children. And some of those people literally couldn't swallow 8 ounces of bread and 2 ounces of cheese two or three times a day. You know, their appetites, you know, weren't that strong. But you were always given your full ration. So in 1901, there was an overhaul, and from that point on, you could have a half ration to start off with if you wanted. And also, each workhouse could compile its own weekly menu plan. And there was a list of about 50 different dishes approved for this new system, and a cookbook introduced to go with it. And there were things like Irish stew and pasties, you know, and cake. And, you know, treacle pudding. There was still gruel and porridge in the cookbook, but generally the food did reflect the fact that by the early 1900s, the workhouse wasn't a deterrent place for, you know, skiving, you know, labourers who fancied not working. It was a refuge for the elderly and the sick and the mentally ill, the chronically sick. Single mothers and their children. It was a refuge for, you know, the downtrodden part of society, and things like the food very much changed in tandem with that.
So there you go, Laura. Authentic gruel, half-strength porridge. Easily done, I think, Nat. So we've got a couple of final questions just about the closure of workhouses and the kind of people's path out of the workhouse. So I'll put one of those to you first, I think, which is Carrie Gillen says, how difficult was it to get employment after leaving? Were people completely left to their own devices to find work when they got out?
I think it varied a bit. To some degree, I think workhouses were used by local employers as potential sources of labour in times when labour was scarce. You know, that would help get some people out of the place if they heard there was a job going at, you know, some company nearby. I mean, in the agricultural areas, there was a very seasonal supply of work. You know, in the summer and the autumn, and the spring as well, I suppose, there was plenty of agricultural work. In the winter, it just dried up. So you've got people in the workhouse for winter, and in the spring that they would know there was labour to be had, and that would get them out as just part of their almost annual routine, going in and out of the workhouse. But it was difficult. I mean, some people trudged around the country, you know, possibly with family in tow, looking for work, and stopping at workhouses overnight. Every workhouse had a small provision for passing travellers, or tramps and vagrants, and people looking for work. So you could actually sort of progress around the country, stopping at workhouses. And there were people, you know, who did use the workhouse in a sense as a way of looking for work, trawling, you know, from city to city, walking between the two places, but, you know, could end up finding work that way. In the early 1900s, it became more common for people in the workhouse to be given work that reflected their previous occupation. So if you've got a carpenter, they wouldn't be forced to do stone breaking. Or there's a bit of, you know, mending on that, you know, staircase over there, and he's doing, you know, set on that, so people would keep their hand in. But as I say, you weren't given, you know, if say you were a workman that had needed tools to do their job and they'd had to sell those prior to coming into the workhouse, then they weren't allowed to receive a handout to buy new tools. It really was quite difficult. You really had to, I guess, take the plunge and just hope for the best in some cases.
Finally, Alan Wire asks, when were the last workhouses closed and what brought about their demise? And then Laurelise XO also adds, and what happened to the people who lived there when they were closed?
Well, there wasn't an overnight closure of the workhouses. In 1930, the control of the workhouses passed from these boards of guardians who'd been doing the job since 1834 over to local councils, who kind of didn't actually do very much. They closed a few of them and they kind of revamped some of them, and they turned them into what were called public assistance institutions. So poor relief had been relabeled public assistance in 1930. That kind of stage of things kind of limped on, you might say, until 1947, 48, when we had the Public Assistance Acts and the NHS appeared. And all these former workhouses generally either stayed on as council-run old people's homes, or they became NHS hospitals, or in some cases, a single site was split into two, serving both purposes. So there wasn't a wholesale emptying of doors. The ones that became old people's homes kept their existing inmates, and it was now called the Limes Old People's Home rather than the, you know, Lancaster Public Assistance Institution. The ones that became hospitals, again, if there were chronic patients in there, they would stay there. So 1948, I guess, it really marks the end of the workhouse system, although the name had sort of officially at least been phased out by them.
What do you think is the biggest misconception about the workhouse that you come across when you answer people's questions like this, that you would kind of want to set the record straight on?
Oh, gosh. I think, well, first of all, you have to appreciate that the workhouse was not set in aspic. It evolved enormously over the years. You know, any system, whether it's health, education, you know, government, over a period of several hundred years, it's going to change. So having an idea that it was like this, wherever that comes from, the whole time is not going to work. The other thing I would say is read as much as you can about the workhouse system and try and ignore the Oliver Twists and so on. I'm constantly depressed, actually. Anything you see on TV or in newspapers, really the popular newspapers, that mentions the word workhouses always starts from the premise that they were grim, miserable, cruel, you know, places. And they then sift for evidence to prove, you know, to illustrate to you that was how it was. I think just approach the subject with an open mind. Don't believe these, you know, colourful, you know, caricatures that are always presented, even now, in most representations you see of the workhouse. Keep an open mind and remember that whatever you're looking at changed throughout that whole period.
That was Peter Higginbotham. His books include Life in a Victorian Workhouse, which was published by Pitkin in 2011. And if you'd like to try some gruel yourself, or even some of the more appealing meals that Peter mentioned, then check out his workhouse cookbook. You can find a link to that in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow for an episode on Jewish women who joined the resistance.